State Affairs, please come to order. It is 9 o'clock sharp on Tuesday, the 16th of February, 2016. We have three bills before us, Senate Bill 127, 123, and Senate Bill 114, which will take up most of our committee time today, and we'll continue public testimony this evening beginning at 6 o'clock. And that is this evening. There was a two press releases sent out. One had an error. It said Thursday the 16th, and we sent one out immediately afterwards. So if there's just to clarify, the testimony is tonight, the 16th of a month that occurs on a Tuesday, because there is no Thursday the 16th. Apologize for that that confusion from our end. We've had a few calls on that for clarification, and hopefully this will help as well. And we have members present, Senator Huggins, Senator Coghill, and Senator Willikowski. We have, we're going to jump right in. We've had the public testimony on 127. If there was still anybody to talk, we'll reopen it for public testimony as a courtesy, but we did close it. But if there's anybody here, we'll take that. Senator Huggins, can you take us back to where we left off?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Number one, Ms. Rasmussen will come forward. And, of course, we have the administration, the insurance director with us to answer any specific questions that may have arisen. I think members have brought those forward, and we have those answers available. But just to remind each that if we look at the Arkansas model, roughly 48% of the people benefited from credit scoring. Another 38.9% were held harmless, and the remainder, you know, had some impact in the other direction. And I think for those that might take exception, the extraordinary life circumstances and events provision is one that has a large safety net for others. And with that, Mr. Chairman, you know, I'm comfortable where we are in this bill. But as I said, for any questions that arise, we have subject matter experts here, and Ms. Rasmussen's here.
Thank you. First, I'll ask if there was anybody from the public that wished to, or folks in the administration that wished to testify or put anything else on the record. Anybody wish to testify on Senate Bill 127, the insurance for summary credit scoring legislation? With that, we'll having reopened, we'll go ahead and reclose the public testimony. Did you have anything you wish to add, Ms. Rasmussen?
Through the chair, I don't have much to add. Just here, if we wanted to go through the bill again, just a brief overview. Otherwise, I believe we have the Division of Insurance to answer questions outstanding from last week's hearing.
Why don't we bring forward Ms. Wing-Hire, and she provided in a pretty timely fashion some specific answers to the questions that committee members asked, and since they've gone to the trouble of getting those, let's put those on the record. The Director of the Division of Insurance, on behalf of the Walker Administration.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Lori Wing-Hire. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance.
You have a copy of your letter with you? Good.
I do. We were asked last week to answer a few questions. One was regarding the use of credit scoring in health insurance underwriting. And credit scoring is not allowed in under the Affordable Care Act or in the by state law in the underwriting of health insurance. The other question was posed by Senator Willikowski, and it was the use or the impact, more importantly, of credit scoring on low income and possibly the use of the impact of credit scoring on race. He cited Hispanic and black Americans in his district. And while there has been some data that shows that low income and black Americans, Hispanics, and such have been impacted, there has not been enough data to show that it has been a significant impact. But there have indeed been studies that have shown that there has been a slight impact to lower income, but it has not been a racial impact on the studies. And in my letter, I cited the FTC, the NAIC, a study that was done by the Commonwealth of Virginia, and their conclusions were all as pretty much came to that there was not much of an impact drawn from low income, and particularly on race.
And on the fiscal note, while you're up here, you have a zero fiscal note, but you did testify this will reduce your workload. Can you elaborate on that or clarify that for the record?
We submitted a fiscal note last year. I don't remember if we submitted it this year or last year. Had to be this year, I'm sorry. But we did submit a fiscal note, zero fiscal note, that we assumed it would reduce our workload because of the consumer that call in and the brokers that call in regarding credit scoring, and their majority are complaints or just concerns of when they get their billings.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Wingheyer? Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. We heard a lot of complaints or concerns from the insurance industry expressing concerns of their consumers that upon renewal, those with good credit were impacted, that they saw their rates rise. And as I read the statute as it's currently written, the insurance company can actually, if the consumer chooses, can waive that provision and can consider a person's good credit. Or bad credit, for that matter. Isn't that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that is absolutely correct. They can. The issue has been the having to go back in and either find a new insurer, so you're a new client again, or having to do the waiver itself, the time it takes.
Senator Wilkowski.
Right. But all the concerns and the stories that we heard about people with good credit going for renewal and seeing their rates spike, the insurance company could simply go to the consumer and say, hey, would you like to waive this provision? And they could, it's probably just a little signature on a sheet of paper, just waive that provision, and then they could take advantage and receive the benefit of having good credit. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I believe that was a testimony of State Farm, correct?
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Wingheyer? When you testified, you had a positive tone in favor of the bill. Is that has the administration taken a position on the bill?
The administration is neutral on this bill, sir.
Thank you. I wanted to put that on the record. Despite your positive comments, the administration has remained neutrality. I just wanted to make sure that was on the record, not to your support of the bill and your testimony is neutral. So. Appreciate that. Any other questions? Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Senator Huggins, would you like to make a motion?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that Senate Bill 127, with individual comments, zero fiscal note, be moved to the next committee referral.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, the bill is moved from committee. Next, we have Senate President Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please, and anybody you wish to join you. We had we did not have a quorum when we heard this bill previously, but so we kept public testimony open. We had an initial discussion of the bill and a presentation, We took public testimony, but so that remains open because we lacked it. We had four members that were participating through a combination of those of us here and participating, but in deference to the public process and our uniform rules, it's still before us as if it's its first hearing. So why don't we, just because it was on a Saturday, and why don't you, if you can just restate your your intent on the bill and the specifics of it, Mr. Senate President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the State Affairs Committee. Okay, I won't go through everything again, but again, all this bill is trying to do is mirror the ordinance that the City of Anchorage has already passed, having to do with texting and driving. The thought behind changing this from a Class A misdemeanor to a $500 fine, or basically make it similar to a traffic citation, is in hopes of getting better enforcement. As we talked about on Saturday, there was only 20 cases that had actually been enforced, and only four of those actually went to court. So the current law is not working, and it's not hard to see that there's still a lot of people out there texting and driving, which is extremely dangerous, as we all know. And the whole intent here is to have better enforcement so that people don't text and drive. It's not intended whatsoever to be a revenue bill. That's why this is not going
That's
to be
kind of a mixed bag. You might not get it heard in the House. I know.
Yeah, don't know, but it's not going to the Finance Committee, so it's not a revenue bill. It should save the state money, because when you do have to prosecute somebody for a misdemeanor, you have to get a search warrant if they're texting and driving. Get a search warrant, obtain the cell phone, investigate the contents of the phone, and then try the case in court law, which of course is very expensive, and I think that's why it hasn't been done much. So we think that this will be easier to use and implement, and be if anything, it's a safety bill rather than a revenue bill.
Yeah, we had testimony from Ms. Mead from the court system about it becomes a bailable offense where the person can plead guilty and pay the substantial fine, or can plead guilty or no contest, and then or ask for a trial. And in the case of most traffic tickets, people pay the bailable offense, or they're supposed to. We had the discussion. It's something that courts have to approve, but it was anticipated by Ms. Mead that this would be something that the courts would accept as an add to that list of available offenses, just for the record.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Senator Meyer? I'm going to ask if there's any public testimony on this bill. Is there anybody here wishing to testify? We have David Hansen. He's a lieutenant in the Alaska State Troopers. He's here for questions only, but since he has taken the time to sign up, maybe he can provide some field information on enforcement, at least on the state troopers end. This is Lieutenant Hansen. Are you still there, sir?
Yes, sir, I am.
Did you hear the question? Just general comments on what the enforcement has been, and I'm not asking you to take a position on the bill if the administration hasn't taken a position. But your comments as a professional in the field and supervising those in the field.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Thank you so much. Good morning, everyone. My name, just for the record, is David Hansen, and I'm a lieutenant with the Alaska State Troopers based in Anchorage. I've been with the troopers for about 22 years, and in my current assignment, I'm the deputy commander of the Alaska Bureau of Highway Patrol. And in this position, I oversee the activities of the patrol troopers dedicated to working in the Alaska Highway Traffic Safety Corridors and at special events around the state, which basically focus on the reduction of serious injury and fatality crashes. Most of my comments are going to mirror what Senator Meyer has already stated. In reviewing our case records within DPS from 2012 to 2015, all 4 years inclusive, the Alaska DPS initiated a total of 69 cases involving a driver that was texting, operating a screen device, or otherwise distracted while operating a motor vehicle. Of this total of 69, 17 were charged under the regulation 13AAC 02495C, which is largely a catch-all regulation in respect to this offense, in that it addresses drivers that are generally distracted by something in the vehicle, whether it be, you know, a driver trying to eat or a small dog or electronic device. The other 52 cases were actually charged under AS 2835161, the statute addressed in this bill that specifically speaks to prohibiting screen devices. So this is essentially roughly 13 cases each year, or slightly over one case per month. Part of the reason the troopers are perhaps less likely to charge an individual with the Class A misdemeanor under 2835161 is the burden of proof requirements when it comes to the criminal proceedings. In a misdemeanor trial, the trooper would be required to provide evidence that the driver was distracted by a screen device, whereas the trooper might, they might have an in-car video system that can capture bad driving, like weaving within the lane, abrupt braking, excessively slow speeds because they're distracted by something else. Even though that may be true, it is oftentimes difficult and sometimes even unsafe for the trooper to attempt to document a driver texting or using their phone for a reason that violates the statutory definition. The result of that is that the trooper would appear to testify in a trial or in a criminal case with little or no physical evidence, unless the driver happened to consent to a search of the device to allow the trooper to capture the evidence needed for a successful prosecution. So reducing this crime to a violation would result in allowing a trooper to observe the offense, much like they would observe a driver, say, running a stop sign or making an illegal lane change, and simply cite them into court. This would still allow the driver to have the due process option and would encourage law enforcement to contact more drivers observed committing this offense, and even just to educate them on the dangers of texting while driving and to take whatever appropriate enforcement action is justified at the time. So the only thing that we would say looking at this is that there would need to be an established bail amount for each offense, whether that's, you know, the same throughout or, you know, a certain amount for the initial offense and then higher for subsequent offenses.
And that would be the domain of the court system to establish those. I think they would take the advice of the legislative branch, but they still have that authority. Is that your understanding as well, Senator Meyer? Any other questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
I may. The officer mentioned 69 cases, and I mentioned 20.
We're dealing with the municipality of Anchorage.
Exactly. That was just Anchorage. He's talking statewide. Hey, just want to clear that up.
We didn't doubt you for a minute, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to just ask one last time if there was any public testimony. That will go ahead and close public testimony. And this is clearly a policy call, and I think one individual's members have thought about. We all thought about it, maybe not as deeply as this time when we voted on the original bill in 2012. Certainly, this appreciate you bringing this forward.
Yep.
And I'm glad it's part of a separate piece of legislation, not tucked away in an omnibus bill, so that we can actually focus on this detail and give it the due attention. So I know there's always a temptation to put your bill.
Mr. Chairman, if I may add to, and again, we discussed this briefly on Saturday, that the rest of the bill that we passed back in 2011 doesn't change. So in other words, if you're texting and you injure someone, it's still a Class C felony. If you seriously injure someone, it's still a Class B felony. And if you kill somebody, it's a Class A felony. So the rest of the law we're not changing. We're simply just changing the texting and driving portion.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Senator Meyer. This bill comes to the Judiciary Committee next, and so I just want to put on the record, I support the bill. I can't wait to hear it, but I will ask a couple questions there so that law could maybe prepare. I just want to be clear that the search and seizure protections that Alaskans have under the United States Constitution and our own still exist and remain, and would like to hear a little bit more about that on the record at Judiciary, but this isn't the appropriate place.
We wanted to leave plenty of work for you. With that, are there any other questions? And let me take a brief at ease. I just wanted to look at the fiscal notes again. We're back on the record. There are no other questions from the committee. Mr. Vice Chair.
Chairman, I move that we move the Senate Bill 123 from committee with individual recommendations in the attached zero fiscal notes.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, there's been two bills moved out of committee without any DNA. So
let's move a third.
You want to?
I mean, while we're on the at this pace.
With that, we'll take a brief at ease while we set up the next, that bill's moved out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note zero. So we'll take a brief at ease while we're setting up for the next presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're back in order in the Senate State Affairs Committee. We have continuing presentation of Senate Bill 114. We stopped at a point, but Senator McGuire, you're going to go back and recover some of your previously discussed. And it has been a week since we've had the presentation, so it's your show, Madam Senator.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the State Affairs Committee and the public who is watching. I decided to go ahead and move back in the presentation and recap what we've talked about, knowing that Alaskans are busy and may not have tuned in for the first part of it. If I were to start where we were in the presentation, people might assume that we'd already reached a philosophical point where we were just deciding whether to keep the payout of the permanent fund dividend check, hold it harmless this year, or move into this structure, and I didn't want to do that. I'm going to start by reading, without saying the name of a person, an email that I received, and all of the State Affairs Committee members have received it. As an Alaskan resident, if I might read, Mr. Chairman, as an Alaskan resident, I've watched for decades how the Alaska government has mismanaged our economy and budget. With the current chaos on world oil markets, things have reached a fever pitch. Before everyone follows through with knee-jerk reactions, I'd like to add my voice to the din. First, ignore the idiotic notions by the GCI's lobby. None of it addressed the most fundamental problem, your spending. I had lunch with then-Governor Parnell several years back and told him that excessive capital investment is stupid because it not only doesn't guarantee your growth, but it guarantees greater carrying costs at the expense of the budget. Math is simple. As At some point, some of you will have to learn how to do it. Stop spending. Leave the permanent fund dividend alone. Find more ways to siphon funds. Rating the CBR and the PFD, whatever. Don't do anything to solve the root of the problem. And that root is undeniably undisciplined, unsustainable spending by the Alaska government. So I'm not going to say the person's name, but what I want to say is I like that email. I think that is a raw, honest assessment of how Alaskans are feeling in some places about what's happening here in Juneau. And as I made the presentation on Senate Bill 114, I started with the premise that I would prefer to be anywhere talking about anything but this particular subject. And I used the example of a root canal in one point or the stages of grief at another point, and then just pointed out that I'm a messenger, a member of the body that has the ability to drop in a bill, and decided in April of last year, after 4 months of looking at all scenarios, all possible oil prices, all possible cuts, that fundamentally we would not be able to stabilize even a basic level of government without doing some kind of a restructure of the permanent fund itself. So I want to start by saying I too looked at all of the different options and bargained and denied and ultimately came back to the place I am today. I want to respond to this Alaskan and other Alaskans by saying that here in the Alaska Senate and in the Alaska House and in the governor's floor, there is discussion about the size and cost of government. We sometimes say cuts, and we sometimes say reductions, we say caps, but the notion is the same, that the size and cost of government is not going to be sustainable. I use the example of a family that had been living through a time of largesse, purchased lots of things that everybody came to enjoy in their family unit, and arguably could find a reason to justify keeping them. But that in times of crisis, that family certainly wouldn't keep the extra playhouse, wouldn't keep the extra car, wouldn't keep an extra home in a sunny location. That this is that time in the Alaska economy and in our history where we are going to have to do a serious reflection, both with ourselves and with the public, about needs and wants and the size and cost of government. So to assure that person who emailed this that we're doing that, and that is probably the biggest conversation going on at Juneau, and has been going on for the last at least 5 years. So to emphasize that. And that any kind of fiscal solution will necessarily involve restructuring the size and cost of government, and that what I like about this bill is it necessarily does not intend to fill the assumption of $5.1 or $5.2 billion. It only attempts to stabilize the volatility of the commodity of oil and to manage this large single asset that we have in the permanent fund into perpetuity. Next, I want to address the issue of the GCI lobby, and this is a really important thing. I found in my time in 16 years serving, your word is your bond, and the second thing is tell the truth, be candid. Whatever it is, get it out and talk about it, because if you don't address it, other people will assume that it's true, or they'll assume that some version of it is. So I, in presenting the bill, I talked about how this bill came to be, and I mentioned that it's common to see lawmakers take out sticky notes, scraps of paper, and kind of vision, and they get an epiphany, a moment. And so in January of last year, we were finishing up on the Arctic and energy, and I knew I was entering my last year of service to the state. And I knew that the one single thing, the one huge elephant in the room still facing Alaskans, was this conversation about the size and cost of government and the fact that we were wholly dependent on one single commodity that was still volatile and had been volatile through my entire lifetime and through my entire time serving. And that when you looked at the data, you could see that the legislature absolutely spent and retracted, grew and retracted every single time in response to the price of oil times the volume, period. And that was our single story. So I said to myself, what could I do to help be a part of leaving a more stable legacy for Grayson, for our grandkids? And I looked at all of the possibilities, the CREMO plan, the percentage of market value plan that I voted on when I was in the House of Representatives. I looked at some of Mike Hawker's modeling. And what I came away with was Senate Bill 114. And I decided that this was the best set of tools to put into a bill to drop in April. I approached the Senate finance members, talked to them about it. They were in budget discussions at that time. It made sense for me to drop it. So to be clear on the record, this bill, Senate Bill 114, was drafted in my office with my staff in conjunction with a lot of brilliant economists around the state. No one from the private sector helped create this bill. No one wrote it. No one helped me think about it. And I want to make that 100% clear on the record today. Now, what has happened that has been surprising and continues to delight me about Alaska is that in August, I started receiving a series of phone calls. There were a group of individuals that had been asked to form a team of extraordinary gentlemen and women to advise the governor on what he could do to solve the state's budget deficit. And everything was on the table at that moment. And I started receiving phone calls from people who found on page 42 of a briefing packet of all the proposals out there, Senate Bill 114. And they liked it. And they wanted to understand a little bit more about how it worked, whether it had legs, and those types of things. One of those companies, one of those people is Ron Duncan, who is the CEO of GCI, one of the largest private sector employers. And so we sat down, we talked about it, and he said, I want permission to go back to the group and say, I like this bill, and can we talk about it? And he did. And the rest became history, because of those 30 people, some of them competing business interests, some of them public sector folks, some of them nonprofit folks, some of them not related to the government at all said, let's at least talk about it. They formed a group later on, combining very amazing interests when you think about this. At one point, Vince Beltrami, who heads up the AFL-CIO in Alaska, one of the larger unions, and Ron Duncan were on opposite sides of negotiating teams. I mean, probably angry type of an environment. They are together on the same side of this team, the Alaskans for the Future. And there are a bunch of other members. You can go on their website and see it's ebbing near 100. But to say in your bargaining process as a lawmaker or as a member of the public, that you want to say someone in the private sector supports a bill, therefore I don't support it, I would just respectfully ask you to understand those aren't the facts. The facts are that this is not a private sector driven bill. That's number one and the most important fact. And number two, that it can be a good sign when you have people in the public that are employing private sector people that look at this and say, we have to do something because my business is going to be affected. That's not necessarily a bad thing. All right, finally, the third paragraph is, I want a permanent fund dividend check and leave it alone, essentially. And I want to go back to one of the main points that I made in the slides, and it starts here on this page. And this is the history of the permanent fund itself. And as I continue to work on this bill, Mr. Chairman, I read a lot about what people were saying when these things were created, when these institutional elements were put into place. The permanent fund is a genius. We're one of the few states in the United States that has a sovereign wealth fund, and good for us. Hammond was of course, a major architect of that. I have quotes that I can share with you where he talks about what it was designed to do. And I mentioned on the record that in 1976, as it went before the voters and there were the voting pamphlets and discussions about it, I would say if Hammond leaned anywhere at that time, he would say against the notion of paying out dividend checks. He was more on the side of saying, of course, there was nothing to hand out then. This is 1976 and discussions. But I would say he was more on the side of creating an enduring source of revenue that converted non-renewable resources into renewable resources and that wealth would be shared across future generations. So that was the most important premise that I've been able to read about, was that we wouldn't necessarily have that money in the future. This was going to be a huge boom. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline was going to bring in unseen wealth, unprecedented wealth, and that we had to find a way to save it for future generations. Now you flash forward to 1977, and on this slide, I talked about the fact that there was a committee substitute to what was then House Joint Resolution Number 39. And there were people like Hugh Malone and others, Clem Tillion, that were part of this process. And they all put in statements onto the legislative record, and you can read those. It would be no different than us reading today a floor debate that takes place on the Senate floor. Your reasons for supporting something and yours and yours and yours may be slightly different. But the gist of it was that in 1977, there was a belief that if a method statutorily of handing out dividend checks to Alaskans were created, it would permanently tie the people of Alaska to protecting this solid asset, and that it would be a way of sharing subsurface rights with the people who were not otherwise able under our Constitution to privately develop and return profit from those resources. And that's fine. And that legislature decided to go ahead and create a program. That program, interestingly enough, looks nothing like what it does today. That program was designed to reward longevity and would have ultimately paid out to a small population of the state what so-called pioneers dividend checks. I then pointed out that in 1981, there was an argument before the state Supreme Court in a case called Zobel versus Williams that was then decided June the 14th of 1982. The premise of that case, Mr. Zobel challenged the statutorily created dividend program, remembering that the Constitution created the permanent fund itself. That sat out there by itself, sort of undefined yet, about its role into the future. Legislature came in and said, let's pay out some dividend checks from it statutorily. Court came back and said, it's a violation of the equal protection rights of individual Alaskans under the 14th Amendment to pay it out the way you want to. And I agree with this case. I think they were absolutely right. The net effect was a legislative overlay by a different branch of government. Not a legislative, a legal overlay. So we have the three branches. You've now seen all three act in a series of 5 years. I think this is fascinating in Alaskan history. You have the governor proposing, the legislature approving in three quarters to go before the people, and the public voting on a corpus. You have the legislature, having been duly elected in the Senate and the House by the people, deciding on a way of paying out part of that corpus. You then have the third branch, the court, the judiciary, deciding that the method the legislature chose to pay out was wrong and unconstitutional. So there's the rest of it. The rest of it is now, as a result of all three branches over a period of time, a program that pays out a dividend check to every man, woman, and child in the state of Alaska based on a calculation that's fairly complicated and fairly sustainable. But the net effect is that single largest asset, totaling roughly $50 billion, has over the course of our lifetime now done nothing more than pay out dividend checks to Alaskans. And that's a great thing. I don't say it in a de minimis way. I say that's what it's done. Okay, so next slide. In our office, we looked at it and we said, is it appropriate, number one, for the legislature to consider using the single largest asset the state has, the permanent fund, in a different way? Is it appropriate? And I answered that question, yes. Not only is it appropriate, but I swore an oath every year under to the Constitution that I would uphold the tenets of that Constitution, and I would exercise my job, my duties of my job for the people for their benefit. And I decided that to sit back and do nothing was a violation of that for me personally, because I knew the state was in a deficit.
I'd like to just go back on some of the history. We referred to the joint resolution that which was passed by the two-thirds of both bodies and forwarded to the voters. But just historically, there was first a statutory legislature passed a statutory framework for the permanent fund, and Governor Hammond vetoed it in deference to a more permanent constitutional amendment. Just for the just filling in a gap. And as we had the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General, I just it gave me a real stark reminder that the Attorney General works for his client, the governor. As I remember, a very respected attorney, Attorney General Avram Gross, argued fervently, representing his client, the case, the constitutionality of the dividend paid with disparate payments to Alaskans, and supported it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Even Judge Rabinowitz, up for re-election, retention that year, ruled in favor of that. So every once in a while, politics gets in the middle of this, and it reminded me of that when we had Attorney General Richards there speaking on behalf of his client. And remember to take that in a grain of salt as we're getting legal advice from the administration, and that's why I'm glad we have a separate entity. I don't mean to interrupt, but I just wanted to put those things on the record.
Fair point, Mr. Chairman, and happy to talk, perhaps in a...
I didn't want to interject the whole Constitution, but I just wanted to put it on the record.
It's a conversation, but to be clear, that statutory proposal represented in its framework exactly what ended up being proposed. And so it is true, but not a material difference in the outcome. But it is
material that it was enshrined in the Constitution.
I will incorporate the statutory proposal that failed into the slide.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And the second point is I'm happy to talk about the decision by Attorney General Avril Gross, but I would like to just say as we move into that, and that will probably be, I would assume, the final hearing on it, as we discuss a constitutional proposal versus a statutory proposal, that me personally, juris doctorate, lawmaker, looked at it and said, every sound reading that I have says that it is the corpus that is constitutionally created and protected, and it is a statutory overlay of 21 and 11 that created the current method of paying out a dividend with that Supreme Court overlay. And knowing that, I said to myself, is it appropriate? One, yes. And can I do it by statute? And the answer came back, from my opinion, this one lawmaker's opinion, as yes, I could. And so then I set about saying, what do I want to do? First is I wanted to confirm, is there a problem? So this slide is important. We have a deficit in the size and cost of government and what we can bring in now. And I wanted to refresh people's memory about what that is. I also wanted to point out the legislature has enacted heavy spending cuts over the last 2 years. There are two things that I feel like I clear up more often than not in neighborhood meetings, misconceptions about the legislature over the last probably 6 years. The first is the legislature never cuts. We do and have huge amounts of cuts. Last year, almost $1 billion just alone. The second is that we've never created savings accounts. We always spend it and we never save. That's equally not true. And so I want to point out in the second bullet, the state has several savings accounts, and there's a slide I'm going to get to three or four later that shows, Mr. Chairman, the statutory budget reserve that the legislature created when oil was at $147 a barrel. And I'm very proud of that time. All members here at this table were a part of creating that savings account, and it saved us for a few more years. Revenue models show that if oil prices don't rebound, the savings will be gone in 2 years. My personal opinion is that we cannot wait and hope for high oil prices. Every data point that I have seen globally says that oil would have to be $108 a barrel times the volume we have today in order to just balance the budget we have, and that is extremely unlikely. So the price of inflation could be disastrous for the future. Next slide, and I'll just whip through these. This slide, again, just to refresh people's memory, these are facts, and you can decide to deal with facts differently. The chairman just made an excellent point. You may believe that paying out a dividend is somehow constitutionally protected, and you can argue your facts on that.
That's not the argument I was making.
Okay.
I was making about the framework of how the permanent fund was created. The dividend
Good.
Was a statutory.
Good.
And I was only remarking that when the governor created the constitutional framework, that
and
I'm really referring to the larger plan, not the dividend
okay.
portion.
And I appreciate it. I appreciate that clarification as well, because there isn't a lawmaker that I've talked to yet in this building, even if they don't want to do this, even if they don't want to do something else, even if they want to wait, that will not agree that the corpus is what's constitutionally protected, and it is the dividend program itself, the paying out, that has been a conversation and an enactment of the legislative body. And then a reminder that we don't bind each other. We are prohibited from that. So we have the right and the obligation to reflect on our current circumstance and to decide how the dividend should be paid out, whether it should be paid out, and whether an appropriate use of the permanent fund corpus itself for stabilization of government is necessary. So here's what we're spending right now, 5.2. I've already said that I personally believe a restructure is in order. Not necessarily because there's a dollar in there that I don't have a constituent to link to, because I bet I do. After $1 billion in cuts almost last year, it's starting to get really painful. And every one of those $5.2 billion have a human Alaskan face behind them. They have federal dollars that they leverage. They have classrooms they fill. They have potholes that they repair. So don't kid yourself that this cutting process is going to be easy. It's not. The low-hanging fruit in many, many ways has been gone. But the point I made is that it's still appropriate to say you're spending more than what you're taking in, so you've got to contract. But today, we are spending $3.6 billion from our savings, $531 from other revenues, and the most important part of this slide that I want people to take away, we only have $1,062,000,000 of actual dollars coming in to pay that expense of five. That is your household. That is your household. Put it in whatever dollar figure you want and imagine that only one-fifth of your actual cost of your household is being paid by current revenues. That's the problem. It's not just a spending problem, it's a revenue problem. So next slide. Five stages of grief, I just refresh it because people are going through them. What's the cost of doing nothing? This slide. If we do nothing, there's your revenue in the blue. And it does go slightly up, looking, amalgamating global forecasts, again, for the single commodity we depend on. Nevertheless, budget right there, and that's just a regular COLA cost of living adjustment up there, not even a massive increase in the size, but also not a reduction, to point that out. Nevertheless, you can see the gap. Move the red line down a bit, move the blue line up slightly. Nevertheless, that's your gap. Next slide. This is the most important slide to Alaskans. If you wrote this email, if you wrote an email like it, this is your slide. Because if we don't do 114 or something like it, this is the fact of what's going to happen. The dividend will have to be considered. Whether it's paid out or not, the choice can be considered here or it can be considered later. And so if we do nothing, you can see along the bottom, that's FY16 going out to FY25. And right there in FY22, you see that is the logical end of a dividend program if we do nothing, Mr. Chairman. But the three fiscal years preceding it, 19, 20, and 21, that's where the difficulty is going to come in. Because those members of the legislature that are still here are now going to have eaten through all of the constitutional budget reserve savings, all of the general fund, and they will still be only taking in slightly above $1 billion, maybe two. And now they're going to have to decide with the earnings reserve account, the $7 billion that's left, what do they do? Are they going to pay a dividend out and not cover the size and cost of government? Because we know that they can't go into the corpus without a constitutional vote, right? We know that. And we know that oil fields take a long time to develop, to come online, to get into pipeline, and other sources of revenue. So flip to the next one. So again, these are just the raw numbers. I say 7 and 7, and blue and green, I like it. It just shows you that besides the single largest asset, the permanent fund itself, the $50 billion, and the revenue that's coming in, the only thing else we have, there are sub-accounts. I agree with what this gentleman is saying, but they all incorporate into the blue and the green. You have general fund and constitutional budget reserve, and you have the earnings reserve account, and roughly they equal $14 billion. So you can even just do simple math in your head and say that if we didn't do anything to the size and cost of government at $5 billion, just divide it. I mean, that's a simple way to do it. But this way, you can at least see that the logical thing would be that the legislature will go into the constitutional budget reserve. We already did that last year. We hadn't done it for 12 years. But they'll go there first. We'll go there first. It's three-quarter vote. And assuming you could get all the way up to $7 billion by, use up the $7 billion by fiscal year 18, now you're presented with that slide back there, which is the earnings reserve account. The net effect is that even if you use them both, by fiscal year 20, you're out of money, period. Those are the facts. Next slide. So in crafting 114, I just want to remind people, this is not GCI's bill. This is not AFL-CIO's bill. This is not your neighbor's bill. This is a Senate construct. It was created in our office, and I wrote out, and still have the sheet of paper I wrote it on, the principles that I had in mind. And this can help you consider whether you want to support this concept or not. You should always ask a member when they put a bill together, what were the principles they thought of when they created it? First, retain a dividend. I personally believe a dividend check has become an important link for the people to the actual permanent fund itself. And I think it's an important link, and I think we should keep it. I also think the dividend check has become an important part of people's income, whether we agree with that or not. I haven't talked about my dad at all this legislature on purpose because it's hard for me to. But I remember the first dividend check that was paid out. And my father held a dinner, my brother and I, to attend. And every once in a while he would hold court that way. And you always knew it was quite serious. And our dividend checks were on the table. And next to them were $100 bills laid out in succession equaling $2,000. And I'd never seen that much money in cash in my life. And it was such a formative thing for me because it's the first moment as an eighth grader that I connected a check to actual cash and then to concepts. And my parents said, God bless you, my parents said, these are your checks, take a look at them because it's the last time you're going to see them. And you are going to have a hard time because you're going to be in class with kids who, some of them won't ever see them either for different reasons. Their family needs the money. Some of them are going to tell you about the latest record. We had records then. Record that they bought, whether it was...
Can you explain that for younger
people? No, I tried. I showed Grayson a cassette tape the other day, and he was fascinated. He looked at it for an hour. So, you know, I think it was Joan Jett and the Blackhearts and AC/DC, whatever the album was we were listening to at that time. They're going to buy albums. They're going to buy new jeans. And you're not going to get to. And we're going to explain to you why. Your mother and I are matching each of your permanent fund dividend checks, and they're going into a certificate of deposit. You remember those two? Those used to make money. There was like 8.2%, unbelievably. And a certificate of deposit, I didn't know what that was. Can't touch it. Can't touch it until you go to college. And we were devastated. And so at that moment, I formed my relationship to the permanent fund. And I had the chance to see 1,000 miles away that I wanted that money and I wanted to use it and I wanted to become dependent on it and I didn't want it to go into a savings account. So I get it. I totally get it. That said, my dad went on to say, I'm concerned this will be the death of our state. Really, really wise words. And his concern about it was that the perversion of the permanent fund that he supported himself and many pioneering Alaskans had would become a method of paying out dividend checks such that people lost track of where it came from and became dependent on it and would atrophy, become so reliant that it's almost a pinky finger. And then what do you do? Now they haven't worked to make that pinky work. They've got it. Doesn't matter about any of that, because I would say that he forecasted a lot of the things that are happening today. There's a deep concern that we all have about entitlement in the state. There's a concern that we all have about the people being too far away from the source of revenue that funds the very roads they drive on. And there's also a very real concern about stratification that has occurred between income levels in our state and the fact that the dividend has now become a material part of people's budget. People actually use the permanent fund dividend check to live on, They pay their light bill with it. They pay their mortgage with it, if they have a mortgage. They pay a health bill with it. So the dividend is important, and if you believe the dividend is important, this is your bill, because it is the only bill right now that is fluctuating through any of these bodies that says there a dividend will be paid. And no less than $1,000 of a dividend will be paid. If you're a person in this building that doesn't like that and doesn't want to guarantee a $1,000 dividend, this isn't your bill. There are other bills that will allow that dividend to slide and fluctuate depending on the state's ability to pay. So recognize that's a premise right there. Even aside, including aside the conversation with my father, the dividend's important. Number two, reduce the volatility of the state budget. That's the most important thing. If oil, if I woke up today, and it would have been joyous, if oil was $208 a barrel, I would still have this bill before you. And I want to say that on the record. This bill would still be before you. Because I believe that there needs to be a stabilization of the way that we handle the state budget and the commodity of oil. Third, wrapping up, clearly expose the size and cost of government. I mentioned before, my bill does not purport to close the gap. That's important. There are other bills that are putting a series of measures in place designed to equal a presumed size and cost of government. This does not. So if you pass Senate Bill 114, you're fixing about half the problem, and you're still going to have to come back to the table and do the hard work, the conversation about size and cost of government. And then fourth, this is actually, of all of these points, this is the most important one. It should be enduring to allow the maximum use of our wealth over generations so that the benefits and burdens are shared. And when you look at the creation of the permanent fund, that was the most important theme that was echoed over and over and over again. The pure unfairness and short-sightedness of taking a non-renewable commodity like oil and using it all up for selfishly for ourselves. And that was in the 70s and 80s, but even still then, and not allow it to be shared with the children and the grandchildren that are created as a result of us having moved here and pioneering this land. So if you don't adopt 114 or something like it, that four is not being met, and arguably your choices to meet it are getting smaller and smaller. They're getting smaller and smaller, and that's very important to me. And then simple and easy to implement. Next slide, I'm going to move through these now really quickly and get to the last part of the presentation. To emphasize again, the emails that come in, I understand them, I respect them. I want to say that. I read that email out of respect. I respect Alaskans. I respect what they say. We are elected by the people. And that's why we are voted out of office when we don't do what they like. I get that. But I want to explain to people that wrote emails like this that this bill is not a raid on the permanent fund. The permanent fund can't be touched without a constitutional amendment. This bill only purports to change the way the earnings reserve account is paid out. It's not a way for the government to increase the budget. As I mentioned before, it's only part of the solution. The conversation will still have to go forward. And it's not a dividend killer. As I mentioned before, it's the only bill that statutorily guarantees a dividend into the future. Next slide. It's a way to connect Alaskans directly to their share of natural resources. These are positive things. It's a way to protect your dividend in the future. Without a structural change, the dividend will go away in a few short years. Those are just numerical facts. Those are not political facts. Those are numerical facts. It's a way to ensure that the services that you enjoy to continue to be provided. I put this up because I do think that Alaskans often can forget that in being a part of a polis and a society, that we do choose to benefit from some basic things that we like. I use the example of not wanting to stand out at the end of your driveway with your AK-47 every morning. And that's a good one, because that's a very real one that our forefathers and mothers lived through as they settled and pioneered in these lands. Without an organized structure of government, without a police force, without firefighters, etc., individuals are left to do every one of those duties they're called on by themselves and their family. Or they can create tribes and mini units. But fundamentally, we've said we have a lot more latitude to get up every day and dream and grow our businesses and take our kids to soccer and all the other things if somebody else out there is running in to fight the fire and we get to run out. And if somebody else is willing to show up on the scene when a murder is taking place, then we don't have to deal with it. If roads are maintained so that we can drive over them and safely arrive at our work destination or to our child's daycare. If people are educated, that's a good thing. Even if your child is in public school, private school, even if you homeschool, those are all great choices for you and your family. But generally speaking, you want an educated society. Health and Human Services, we want basic health. The Marine Highway, Parks and Recreation, Fish and Game. Next slide, and then I'll stop and just go to the chairman for how he wants to continue. These are the impacts of selected options for reducing the deficit on jobs, and it just goes into my last point that if you think budget cuts are going to be easy, that somehow there's this simple solution sitting in a binder that lawmakers just kind of leave over here, and choose to bring in more revenue, choose to talk about restructuring the permanent fund. Absolutely not the case. People in this building have made hard cuts, and the cuts that come in the future are going to have a high cost. Next slide. Without oil revenue flowing through the earnings reserve account, as I pointed out, general funds will continue to swing, and unless limitations are put in place, there are many options. Next slide. This is just a slide to refresh people's memory, Mr. Chairman. I'm expecting the Senate State Affairs Committee to send this bill out with a spending cap. Some method of constraining the growth of government into the future. And this is another thing that wasn't in this email, but if there were a fourth paragraph that I hear, it's, you know, Lisa, you guys are going to fix the problem today, and then when oil prices return, you're going to spend all that money. And that's a fair question and a fair point. So I'd like this committee to consider putting something in place that says, my idea would be the appropriation cannot exceed 120% of the previous year's draw. Next slide. Catching us up. One equation that's defined Alaska's history, the price of oil per barrel times volume, that equals the state's budget. The reason for 114 is not because we have a spending problem. It's because we have a revenue problem, because we've based all of our revenue for the state budget on the price of oil per barrel times the volume. It's volatile and it's unstable. We have to do something. Next slide. Some things we have to ask ourselves: when oil prices rebound, how high? When? Next slide. I showed you this just to reinforce visually how difficult it is for your legislature to balance the budget, because we have a spring and fall forecast that tell us the price of oil is going to be one thing based on West Texas intermediary prices or the Brent forecasting, the Brent commodity index. And you see that in every case, just keep flipping, the red shows what the actual price of oil per barrel was, the fact. And you can see how far off we were. So real petroleum prices, this is back to the Brad Keithley conversations and others. We've had rich, robust conversations in this committee. I'm trying to bring them all together as we move to the end of the presentation on 114. I have a lot of data that I am happy to provide with anyone that wants to see it about the analysis of future crude oil prices. I know Senator Wilkowski has them. I know Senator Coghill has them. Certainly the chairman does. But the fact remains that this is the Energy Information Administration itself. And look how far off they are this year with all the technology in 2016, with our iPhones, our smartphones, our ability to be real-time with the stock market, anything you want to say. That's how far off we are. On the other hand, there are very real things happening, the contraction in China, in their growth. They have driven the commodity price of oil because it's an energy supplier and it's a transportation fueler, and they're one of the last large populations on the planet that are growing, and they're contracting. So that's a fact, and that's going to take a while to recover from. And OPEC, as I mentioned before, is no longer the political cartel power it was before. It will never be again. And that's the shale oil revolution. And that technology is also never going back. So next slide. So oil price projections have been inaccurate. Is the oil international oil market fundamentally different? I think so. Should we bet on oil prices in the future? I believe not. And the way I like to phrase it in my office is, should we bet Alaska's future on oil prices? That's the question you want to ask yourself. Should we bet our future on oil prices? Next slide. What have we done with savings at high oil prices? I want to refresh our memory, Mr. Chairman, on this because, as I mentioned, the two biggest misconceptions I get that are not accurate. There are lots of accuracies, of course, about us, but one is that we never cut. We never cut. You guys never cut. You say you will. We have been cutting, and you know that, Mr. Chairman. You've led the charge in many cases for cutting. We cut almost $1 billion last year. Can we cut more? Yes. Has the legislature saved? People say no. You guys never save. Have we saved as much as we should? Probably not. And that's why I started with the slide that said a better 114 would include some kind of a spending cap. But this slide shows you the fact that we did save. Not only did we save, but we created an entirely new savings account in 2008, the statutory budget reserve. And this shows you at record high oil prices, people can remember in 2008, global recession, but at that moment, in August of that year, Senator Wilkowski and I actually were traveling around the state talking to Alaskans about what they wanted to see for an energy policy. And all anybody wanted to talk about is the price of oil. They were suffering. Villages had made their bulk fuel purchases before the rivers froze in Mary's neck of the woods and other places at $147 a barrel, and then the economy fell out from under everyone, and the rest is history. We took that money, we put it aside, and we used it all the way up until 2014. 2014 was the last year that we had money to access in the statutory budget fund. Next slide. This right here, how are we spending our money? I get this question all the time. What are you guys spending money on? They point out you had a bare-bones capital budget last year, capital budget and operating budget to refresh everyone's memory. Those are the two budgets put forward in the legislative process. The capital budget in times past, there have been projects in there that individual lawmakers have certainly put forward to benefit their communities. This year, we only, leading that charge, Senator Anna McKinnon, a fiscal conservative, she put a capital budget forward that reflected only federal matches. Only federal matches. Let that sink in. There wasn't a capital project in that budget. So we're done with that. That's not even part of this slide. This right here shows you the 118, which is the mere federal match, or debt service, which is something that, by the way, I want to point out, will become longer and longer and longer if we do nothing either, because, and Angela Riddell is in the room, as our bond rating goes down, just like your credit score, up go the interest rates. You don't have access to lending at AAA rates if you're AA or worse. And the net effect of that is about $100 million per $1 billion more in debt service Alaskans will be paying in that line item. You move down there and you can see that our two largest parts of government are HES and education. They are big, and I think we're going to have to make some changes. But I like this slide, Mr. Chairman, just to remind people that if we cut every worker in HES and every worker in education, you still could not equal a budget solution.
I'd like to just make one footnote on the capital budget last year. The only large item outside of the matching was, you may recall toward the end of the session, a Mr. Charles Wolfer showed up with his legal team and said, put a lot of pressure on us to add a school in Kivalina, which may or may not have to be located. And that was
That's right.
Mr. Charles Wolfer, the enemy of capital projects.
Next slide. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So here we go, this slide again. I think this is so powerful. Back to if you're in the denial stage, just take this slide home and put it up on your bathroom mirror. In the morning when you're brushing your teeth, make yourself look at it. At least make yourself look at it. Even if you don't want to vote for this bill, look at this slide because this is the reality that every Alaskan, not just me, State Senator Liesel, every Alaskan, this is our reality, okay? that all those proposed, and I use the governor's bill just as an example because it's a fairly moderate assumption, not a high change in fishing taxes, not a high change in tourism. The governor said on the record, I didn't want to go too hard on these additional revenues. I wanted to propose ideas. Only $100 million in oil and gas taxes, $29 million in tobacco. Take them all together. Take them all together. You have $457 million. And your deficit's over here at $3,600 million. Next.
$3.6 billion.
Yeah, $3.6 billion.
Sometimes we forget that.
That's right. And I love that about you, Senator Stoltz. You're very good at correcting the record and clarifying things because this is meant to be educational. But I'm getting to the place of saying, look, I showed you cuts alone can't. Yes, we're going to cut. Yes, we'll restructure. But take every job, every dollar in health and social services, every job, every dollar in education, you can't get there. Now take every revenue proposal out there. The governor put, as I said, everything and the kitchen sink, and we still can't get there. So a sound fiscal solution, that's what we're trying to get to, a sound fiscal solution will necessarily involve using the permanent fund. Next slide. If you consider the permanent fund as spending, it's actually our single largest budget item. And I add this later because of how Alaskans feel about their dividend, and I understand that. But actually, the number's larger. In purple, you can put a 2 where the 1 is because the legislature has inflation-proofed every single year the dividend, every single year, to the tune of roughly $1 billion. I don't want to quibble about whether it's $723 million or $850 million. It's in that range. Save yourself $1 billion. So actually, the largest item the legislature is paying out in a time where there is a deficit and there's one-fifth the amount of revenue coming in to cover the size and cost of government, the largest item is paying out dividend checks to Alaskans. And that's okay, but I just want it to be on the record that that's what we're doing. Next slide. So the royalties this is a comparison. Let's just skip over this. This is a comparison of the governor's. The 114, just to refresh your memory, go to the final slide if you would, Jesse. That's the final slide. Okay. The bill itself, the mechanisms, very simple. Again, to emphasize on the record, maybe because I'm not smart enough, or maybe because as a Juris Doctor, I've seen the way that legal challenges can absolutely pull the rug out from under something that you thought was a good idea. Combine it all together, the simplicity of this is what I like. I left the general fund exactly as it is. I left the Constitutional Budget Reserve exactly as it is. I left the Public School Trust Fund exactly as it is. The permanent fund, it remains enshrined in the corporation, in the Constitution, and its corpus is protected. I left the earnings reserve account exactly as it is. The payout is what I switched. And that's important because when you look at some of the other models that are out there, they're proposing fundamental shifts and changes in things like the general fund, the CBR, the ERA, and the corpus of the fund, which have decades of attorney general opinions and decades of Supreme Court opinions and statutory reflection on them that mean things to people. And they mean different things to people, it turns out. So that's the beauty of 114. It keeps everything exactly the same. The swap, I call it, is the royalty part. So right now, roughly 75% of the royalties from rents and royalties from future oil and gas developments. So these are the oil wells, the gas lines, etc. That royalty, 75% of it goes to the government, and 25% of it goes into the permanent fund. That's an additional revenue source that goes into the permanent fund. A lot of people don't know about. My bill will swap it. It's going to put the 25% over into the general fund, and it's going to give the benefit, the higher number, the 75%, to the people of Alaska, so that they will now receive a dividend out of a statutorily created dividend fund. I like it because it creates an incentive for us all to understand where those checks are coming from, to understand that a healthy development economy, again, one that's environmentally responsible as well, but one we can arrive at, benefits you and your pocketbook. The
you
better we do.
This is the central feature of your plan.
It's the central feature.
I just want to make sure.
It's the central feature. It's the most importantly, it doesn't change the structures, because I think that really matters. I would say most importantly, and second, the central feature is it is a shift in the way that Alaskans will begin to understand and appreciate their share of the non-renewable resources of this state. I've already said I think a dividend's important, but let's pay it out every year of this combination of rents and royalties so that we all wake up and look at the price of oil per barrel. Every one of us. We're invested. We want to know, hey, do we have the most competitive system? Why is Alberta getting all the development? Why is Alaska only drilling 50 wells over the course of 2 years, and Texas is drilling 500 of those? Why are we not commercializing our North Slope gas? I mean, 30 years, why are we not doing that? You know what? I'm going to engage in the debate now. It isn't just about those politicians and their money that's going into their capital budget. It's actually my money. It's my family's money. And I do care. And I am involved in the debate. You bet I am. And that's important because we don't have that now. And that is a problem for the future of this state. So the next slide. So that's the swap I mentioned. Next slide. This is just reiterating the exchange of rents and royalties. The second part of it, of course, for the government is I am putting in place something that is not revolutionary. This isn't a source of brilliance from Senator McGuire. The percentage of market value approach of paying out a percentage of a corpus, of a body of money, an amount that you want to use for whatever the purpose. Let's call it a university. Let's call it a nonprofit. In this case, the Alaska state government. This idea has been tested over 100 years. It works, and that's why I like it too. My bill uses tried and tested methods of managing an asset. The notion behind it, they recognize sound principles. You can't pay out more than is necessary to sustain the asset. That's the inflation-proofing part. The bill currently has 5%. I've said to the chairman, make it a better bill. If you want it to be a range from 3 to 8, that's fine. If you want to set a standard by which the Permanent Fund Corporation decides what percent is paid out with you know, generally held accounting principles that say maintain growth in the corpus, I'm fine too. The point is some amount needs to come out to stabilize the cost of basic services in government. So it's called a percentage of market value. It's actually really simple once you look at it. And that's, I'm trying to demystify a lot of these elements. You don't have to have an accounting degree to understand what's happening, Alaskans. You can understand this. This is easy. Next slide. This just shows you the permanent fund earning account, the general fund, and the inflation proofing concept. Senator Stoltz, Chairman Stoltz, has a particular interest in this, and I've sort of delegated it to him to come back and make this bill better in this sense. But this is my assumption right now. Cowen's estimated return on permanent fund investments is actually 6.9%. Under the current bill, as it is drafted, is the percentage of market value would be 5%. So the earnings reserve account would be an additional 1.9%. 1.9% on top of the 25% that's coming in from their rents and royalties, okay? So those two together, in my opinion, inflation-proof the permanent fund without having to have a separate line item of $1 billion.
I'd just like to interject, if we have time at the end, Ms. Rodell has been waiting
to
have a couple minutes to talk about.
In fact, I will end on this slide and have her come up. I think I have summed up the remainder of the slides. The remainder of the slides simply focus on, flash to those quickly, Jesse, if you wouldn't mind, and then I'll leave on that and let Ms. Rodell talk because she's far more valuable on these subjects. This is where we ended last time, and this is the synthesizing 15 slides together. This is one other point the legislature can decide on. If they can agree that we want to use a mechanism like 114 to begin a new way of thinking about paying out a dividend and a new way of stabilizing our basic government, you can keep the permanent fund dividend status quo in October of this year. And that would be a dividend of about $2,000, and the percentage of market value would yield approximately 1.2. Or if you want to begin implementation of Senate Bill 114 prior to that, the dividend would be $1,023.74, and the percentage of market value would be closer to $2 billion. And I only point that out because that's another decision point for this body to decide, this committee to decide as it moves on. But I would like to respectfully yield my time to Commissioner Rodell to answer questions. And
I'll just briefly reassert the intent of the committee. It's to move all the bills forward. I frankly appreciate your willingness to make changes to your bill. I don't know how to fix the governor's bill, and they're relying on a lot of questionable constitutional assumptions. It's a lot tougher to, frankly, I'm not even smart enough to figure out how to crack some of the Rube Goldberg contraptions they've created and the complications. I'm going to punt that to the Judiciary Committee and the Finance Committee because they have much more ownership in their methodology, and I'll let them continue to defend that. But I don't know how to make the changes without getting into, and certainly they have the Attorney General who states what law is and is representing his client's interests, and we have the luxury of a legislative attorney and legislative attorneys who are independent that tell us what we don't want to hear sometimes. Most often, actually.
Well, and to summarize on that point, I think what we walked away from with our legislative legal was two points really is once you create a new fund, a sovereign wealth fund, and again, not a bad idea to propose, but once you create it and you put revenues in there that weren't anticipated, can you ever pull them out legally? Can you pull them out? And the legislature never has done it. It's an untested point. We have put money in. We've lent it to the permanent fund with the idea we'd take it back, but we never did. We just forgave it. So it's untested as to whether or not it's called retrievability in my mind. I say retrievability and sweepability. So can you sweep it back and forth once it's a new fund, the reverse sweep, and then can you retrieve it? I don't know, and I think we left on those two questions that remain answered.
I was very surprised that the administration and the judiciary both were the administration was asserting that we could create dedicated funds, and certainly was an unusual departure that they were advising. It was a de facto creation of dedicated funds, and that really baffled me. That an executive branch was pushing that and relying on court decisions to support that. Again, it was kind of unusual, those two branches of government yielding power to the legislature. I've never seen it before in all my observations of the legislative process, and it just really threw me at it. And I think it's just so complicated that we're going to move it forward just out of deference to... it deserves continued hearings, but with their ownership of the methodology, I don't know how to fix what I think is broken. But that's I wanted all the proposals to move forward, and hopefully all eventually make it to the Finance Committee. And so I can only assert what will happen after it leaves this when it's in this committee. But that's the goal: your bill to move, the governor's bill to move, and maybe a committee bill. So there's another option. But with that, Ms. Rodell, we can go a couple minutes over, I hope, if need be. I know we're all going to have a long day.
Stay here anyway. All day.
And thank you for being here and absorbing the presentation.
Sure. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, and I'm here to discuss any of the points that you would like to...
Well, I think it would maybe your philosophy and more importantly, the trustees' philosophy on inflation proofing and discussion on that. I think that's been the central question.
Sure, and I'm happy, Mr. Chairman, to talk about inflation proofing. Inflation proofing came into being in, I believe, 1982, 1983. It was designed at the time when the Permanent Fund Corporation was only investing in fixed income assets. So it was designed to preserve the purchasing power of the corpus of the fund so that it would be buying new investments. Over the years, the legislative approved list of investments changed, and in 2005, this body recognized the need to remove the legislative list altogether and to give the authority to the Board of Trustees to set forth what the allowable investments would be using a prudent investor rule. If we look at the asset allocation that the corporation currently utilizes, and invest the Alaska Permanent Fund in, you could easily state that 80% of the fund's investments are self-inflation proofing. In other words, their market value already incorporates the concept of inflation within them. And so inflation proofing, as designed 40 years ago, is not as necessary today as it was back then. But I want to note one thing, is that the Constitution is very simple and very clear, and I don't remember what page I was going to maybe page back to where you had the constitutional language on that slide, but it's to invest the income of which will be moved to the general fund. And then, you know, the earnings reserve account was created. So the only way that the corpus gains wealth in that corpus is through the receipt of the minerals and royalty rent revenues that it's entitled to under the Constitution, and any other appropriations that over the years the legislature and the governor have signed into law and moved back. So what's happened is inflation proofing has become a way for the corpus to build up its own wealth because it's not entitled to any of the income under the constitutional construct. So while inflation proofing is no longer necessary in terms of preserving the purchasing power and protecting the corpus against inflation, it has become the method by which we have built the size and the wealth of the fund because it is the only mechanism that has allowed the corpus to retain the increased value of investments. So maybe what I can do, Mr. Chairman, if it's okay, is sort of walk through an example of how this works in practice.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could just say, I really want to stop before you do this on this point for the public to understand that what Commissioner Rodell just said is that the legislature, over the last 20 years, has effectively deposited new wealth into the permanent fund to the tune of roughly $1 billion to help it grow every year as a line item. And I just want to emphasize that point so that it's not lost on the people of the state that your legislature over the last two decades has grown materially grown the permanent fund.
And why don't you probably have the figures off the top of your head, the amount that was constitutionally appropriated and the amount that's been statutorily appropriated?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the constitutionally mandated amounts are roughly in the $25 to $26 billion, and the amount of inflation proofing over that same time period.
And extra special deposits.
And extra special is slightly over $16 billion. So if I take an example of, and the example I've been using is just really simple, is the blueberry pie, right? So we buy a blueberry pie, and that's to just make it simple and not get confused between the
blueberries
from the valley.
Yeah, okay. Blueberries from wherever Alaskans like to pick their blueberries. And this blueberry pie, we buy it, and this is really to illustrate both how the earnings reserve account, how we move money in and out. But I think it's important to the point Senator McGuire was making about inflation proofing as well, is that when we buy that pie, we take a portion of the corpus and a portion of the earnings reserve to buy that pie, and it's roughly a 75-25% split. So if the pie is $20, we're going to take $5 from the earnings reserve account, and we're going to take $15 from the corpus, and we're going to buy that pie. Now, say it's 10 years later, it's an old pie, but it's still worth something, and we want to sell it, and it's now worth $40. And we sell it at $40, and this goes to the inflation-proofing example. We sell it for $40. We would put $15 back into the corpus because that's what the corpus contributed to it, and the balance of $25 would all go into the earnings reserve. Well, what inflation-proofing does is, well, I want to buy another pie, but now pies are $25, and I still have that same split. So now it's going to cost me $12 out of the corpus instead of the original, it's going to cost me $17 instead of the original $15. And so, but I only put $15 back into the corpus. So what you've done with inflation proofing is you've built up that wealth and allowed a mechanism for the fund to keep buying the investments and participating to the same degree that it has participated in the past. In terms of moving that earnings reserve account, so you notice all $20 then went into the earnings reserve account, and that's how that earnings reserve account continues to build, of which we have the distribution formula for the dividend, and only 50% of it remains behind under the current construct.
Senator Wolchowski.
Thank you. Would it be possible for you to put together a chart of how much has the legislature has appropriated for inflation proofing over the years, and then how much that has impacted the dividend over the years?
Through the chair, Senator Wolchowski, we can get that information to you.
And then I guess also going forward, if the legislature were to stop inflation proofing, what the impact over the next, say, 20 years would be to the dividend for failure to inflation proof, or probably 10 years is probably more appropriate, right, because that's where you have your you rely on the earnings forecast.
Well, the problem with direct deposit, everybody used to see that on their stub.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, I think it's important to note the way, I'm sorry I don't have the statutes in front, but, this is ordered, so we pay the dividend first, then we do the inflation proofing, then the balance is left behind in the earnings reserve. So we always pay the dividend first out of the distribution and then do the inflation proofing. So. And that formula, inflation proofing, is in statute as well. And Mr. Chairman, I don't have any other comments other than to answer questions.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. And I appreciated Senator Wolakowski's question. I think it would be great to show that. But as we talk about the future, and the statement was, if the legislature failed to inflation proof, I don't think anybody in this building is talking about failing to inflation proof the corpus at all. I've not heard a single person say that. The question is, how do we do it? And I would just like, if you wouldn't mind, taking a few minutes to just discuss, you already discussed one point, which was 80% of the assets under the prudent investor rule are essentially self-inflation proofed. You already talked about that one point. But just a little discussion about percentage of market value itself, whether or not you believe that's the right amount or that's sustainable, that can inflation proof and help grow it. Would you prefer to have a standard given to you at the corporation to manage it for more growth? Would you prefer more flexibility in a range between 3 to 8%? We've had lots of discussions, and I think it'd be nice to have you reflect on the point of inflation proofing. I personally would just say we will inflation proof whatever we decide to do, but what are the ways we can do it, and what would you prefer seeing?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, at this point, I think we just want to make sure that we're giving all the information as the debate continues, because from our standpoint, from the Board of Trustees standpoint and myself, we have a very simple mission at the corporation, and that's to manage the corpus of the fund, and we move over the income as we're required to on an annual basis, and if and when that changes, we will comply with the statute. So there's a lot of really good discussion and good ideas on a number of fronts, and it'll be interesting to us to see where this all lands at the end of the day. But having said that, to your question on percent of market value in particular,
one of the values of that is this the sense of a lot of accounting rules have changed over the years since the fund was initially imagined and created. And so we have in statute a definition of statutory net income, which is a definition you won't find in accounting, generally accepted accounting principles anywhere. And one of the challenges for us is this notion of income, because income under GAAP is everything, both realized and unrealized. But the way that we move money over into the earnings reserve account, we've always just moved realized earnings because the earnings reserve account has always been available for appropriation. And so if you tried to start appropriating unrealized gains and unrealized losses, we could end up in a tough situation where money is being spent that hasn't actually been realized or recognized in any way, shape, or form. So we've had this concept of statutory net income that we've complied with. I think where percent of market value made the board comfortable back in 2003, 2004, the Board of Trustees passed a resolution in support of a constitutional amendment for percent of market value. And that was to strip this down and just make it very simple, where we recognize the value of the entire fund and we move over an amount available, 5%, 4.5%, whatever that percent is, and that just go over very cleanly under the Constitution, and then the legislature then has that amount available to it to appropriate as it sees fit, including whether or not to pay a dividend. So the percent of market value has advantages in the sense that it allows recognition of a number of different types of asset classes. I think the challenge of not having a constitutional amendment then is recognizing that you only can spend what's in the earnings reserve account. You can't touch the corpus. Under a constitutional amendment, arguably you'd be able to then, I don't want to say spend the corpus, but there would be an easier recognition of all the earnings and the increased value.
Or conversely, more limitations on how you spent the other funds. I don't think this legislature is ready to push a constitutional amendment to pop open the corpus of the fund. And those are the words of the director, not any member of this body.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, just to be clear, I was speaking to, I was asked about the Board of Trustees, and this is a resolution that they passed 12 years ago that is still active. And I think it's a tough question that you all have in front of you, and I don't envy you the job you have before you on any of these fronts, whether it's the administration's bill, Senator McGuire's bill, and then the operating budget bills and capital budget bills. From our standpoint, we will be watching, and we're happy to respond with information requests.
I appreciate the board going on the record. We have another, I don't think we hear enough from the trustees who are certainly a respected board. We hear far more from a pension and trust board that oversees retirements with not only vice but dictates specifically from a citizen and from our trustees often. And I appreciate the reticence to be involved, not to be involved in the politics, but you are the board, the trustees are a valuable resource, and we appreciate. Whether we like what we hear or not, it's important to hear from those trustees. They've been very depoliticized. They've had occasional dalliance and always have recoiled and after they've realized on those rare occasions when they have. And I guess, please.
I would just, and Mr. Chairman, the trustees are very interested in what the discussions are, and they want to understand the ramifications of the bill in terms of being a fiduciary to the fund and how that will affect their management decisions of the fund going
forward if there are any changes to be made, because as I said at the opening, our mandate is actually very simple, and that's just to manage the corpus of the fund for income.
We'll go about another 5 minutes, and we're going to be here late tonight. Senator Wilkie,
okay.
Then Coghill.
Yeah, I just, I guess I have a little different view of this than the chair. I have never seen the permanent fund come in and testify in that I can recall in support of a policy change like this to inflation proofing. That concerns me. I don't want to see the permanent fund become a political arm in any way. I want to see you manage the fund for the maximum value that for Alaskans, and coming in here and suggesting changes, I think is very dangerous. I've worked on bills in the past to change the investment strategy of the permanent fund, and the permanent fund has always said absolutely we don't support that. So I hope that we don't see the permanent fund become a political arm in this fiscal policy debate. I think
like when they supported the divestiture bills.
They oppose my divestiture bills, Mr. Chairman.
Not initially, but Senator Coghill.
No, I'll pass and let.
I just wanted to respond. Just one point to Senator Wilkowski on the record, and I respect what you said, but I want to clarify on the record and for the public and to this committee. I asked Commissioner Rodell not to come here to endorse my bill or support it. Frankly, I didn't know what she was going to say. I asked her to be here as a resource for the committee members and the public because she is the head of the Permanent Fund Corporation. And I also want to point out that in her answers, she was very clear and has been very clear to say she doesn't endorse a particular concept. She is, in fact, she used the words, she's not envious of the fact that we have to make those tough decisions, but that she's more than willing to provide data and opinions about how financial management of those particular choices would occur. And the last thing I just wanted to let you guys know, the chair know, and the committee, the corporation, the trustees asked me to come on Friday. And I believe they've asked the governor as well. They have taken the most active interest I've seen since my 16 years, and I echo the chair. This is Alaska's single largest asset. It's yours. It is yours. It's your permanent fund. And how it's managed and what we do with it in the future is a matter of every Alaskan's interest. So I think the chair is right. It's nice to hear from the trustees. And I just wanted to say a compliment to Commissioner Rodell, Director Rodell, for being available to answer questions, and to them for inviting me on Friday to have a conversation about it. They, too, have said we can't pick sides politically, but we want to understand the mechanisms. And I'm open to good accounting practices or good suggestions, and that's mainly the conversation I'm having is what's the right way to do it to achieve the result of inflation-proofing it.
I'm gonna close with a remembrance of a good friend of mine whose last term in the legislature was during the 16th legislature, and he chaired a special committee created by the House called the Committee on the Future of the Permanent Fund. It was Representative Red Boucher, and the conversations I had with him, we shared passion for baseball, Alaska, and the prospects for a great future. Not necessarily all in that order, but. Maybe baseball was first, I mentioned. But he had a vision. He goes, Bill, if we can get this thing up to $50 billion without touching it, and I'm not saying that now we've reached this imaginary line, but a visionary like Red Boucher said, if we could get it up to $50 billion, if we could not monkey around with it beforehand, and there have been a lot of attempts prior to, and he was a man I respected greatly, and I always enjoy seeing his son, John Boucher here, who is that Red would be proud of the professional role he's taken as a leader in state government, and gave me a chance to remember my good friend Red Boucher and his chairmanship of that committee and his last term in legislative office talking about his vision. And it just struck me, I was thinking, that's what Red had said, if we get it up to $50 billion without touching it first. And not that's the imaginary line, made me remember my good friend Red Boucher, and John, we all loved your dad. So with that, we will come back for public testimony tonight, and look forward to hearing from Alaskans. I think everybody's out there competing to get their elements to testify. I think we're interested as a committee just to hear from Alaskans, period. And I think no matter what attempts are made, Alaskans are usually ones that show up speaking for themselves. So. And that's why we love them. sometimes they're, I'm hoping, no, they're not always, certainly, they tell us what they think, and we're going to listen to what they have to say. And that's really, tonight is going to be a listening session. Today was where we interacted, and we'll get through it all as long as, we just use our role as listening tonight. So with that, I appreciate the amount of time everybody is spending on these bills, and we do have, as I am very cognizant of the calendar and other committees have work, we're also wrestling with this major crime bill as well. Working on a couple of issues, but it is my commitment to move all the bills out on the same day when we do, to show that we have an open dialogue that will continue through at least the Senate process. We can only account for what we do on our side of the body, and so I appreciate the work that folks have put into this, and very diligent work in questioning, and disparate views are coming together to have a good discussion. So looking forward to continuing that. With that, we'll stand in adjournment.